My name's Mary Parker. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Mary.
My sobriety date is November 27th, 1981. My home group is the College Park Triangle Group in Orlando, Florida. And I'm as high as you can get and be from Orlando, Florida. This is really something else. It's just an amazing experience to be here. I found out a month ago I was coming. I am AA's permanent sub speaker, in case you didn't know that. I'm kind of like, I look at myself like a really great pinch hitter, you know, and it's real exciting to be here. My husband could not come, and so he gave me instructions this morning. I am ignoring them. He's a member of that club called Lawyers, and that's the way it goes. I want to thank Judy and Jim. They made this so easy for me. I would just have a thought, and it would all be taken care of. I didn't have to do anything. I didn't have to arrange anything. I didn't have to pick up anything. I didn't have to drive anything. It was wonderful. And we went to dinner the first night we were here and just met some terrific folks. And last night, I earned a new title. I went out to dinner with Joe and Beth, and I am the mashed potato queen of Slogars. I'm real excited about that. That is not because I look so good. It's because I eat so many mashed potatoes. I sat in the corner with my bowl and growled, and people stayed away. I reserve the right not to get over everything all at once. And that's kind of how it is for me. But I'm here to tell you what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. And it's amazing to me that the life I led gave me the opportunity to do something like this. That's just amazing, that this wild, crazy, out-of-control, drunk girl gets to do this. And I am just incredibly grateful to be here and thank all of you. I was born in Ohio, and I have parents. I'm a baby boomer. I'm the first wave of the boomers. I'll be 60 in December. And my father was a World War II veteran. My mother was his childhood sweetheart. They got together and got married. And I was a much wanted and expected child and was the first girl in many generations on my father's side. That was very exciting for them. And they just loved me and wanted me. And years later, all these good things I'm telling you, I felt disqualified me for membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I had a list of things you had to have happen to be here. And I hadn't had them happen. So I wasn't supposed to be here. Just kind of like this conference, I wasn't supposed to be here, but here I am, you know. And that's kind of how my alcoholism was. My parents had two more children. I am not sure why. I was sufficient. Boys, there you go. And I was a scared kid. I don't know where that came from. Again, I was loved and cared for and terrified. I just lived terrified. And my first memory of that is in the first grade. I am, if I do say so myself, quite a fine little reader. And I had a lot of reading ability. I was very proud of that. And I'd cry in school, but when I got to read, I wouldn't cry anymore. And this girl moved in to my neighborhood, and her name was Joyce English. If you're out there, Joyce, I'll make the amends after I'm done. And Joyce began to read, and she read with much more expression than I. And I was very, very upset. I was not only fearful, I was fiercely competitive, and it is a bad combination. And so I hoped and prayed and tried and began to read better than Joyce, and I felt much better. And that was sort of the story of my strange little life. And my father got real tired of the cold, and we moved to Miami. And it was beautiful. This was in the early 50s, and I went to school there, and I cried on the way to school. I was afraid I'd be late. And I cried on the way home because I was afraid I didn't have my homework. I'm just afraid. I'm just born afraid. But I found out I had this little talent. I had a talent for taking tests. I'm a real good test taker. It's like playing the piano. It doesn't mean you can do anything. It just means you can do that. And in high school, that began to work out for me. And I was part of the generation that we were going to beat the Russians. It was the Sputnik era. Some of you are way too young. Just don't worry about it. Anyway, so they throw me into all these math classes and science classes. And I was taking tests and doing all this sort of thing. And I'd get up to say something in class, and I'd say something. And the teacher would start yelling at me because I wasn't speaking loud enough. And I'd stand up and I'd speak and I'd cry. And so that's just sort of what I did. And I was afraid. I was just always afraid. But I was more afraid of not getting to be something really spectacular. I had this strange belief that I was destined for greatness. I was destined, all right. Not quite for what I had thought. And my family was sort of hanging on to the edge of middle class. And they did the best they could, but money was tight at our house, and I just didn't know how I was going to get to college. And my best friend was real smart. When I say she was real smart, today she's a full professor at Penn in the medical school, so she was real smart. And she was my baseline for what I should be like, and I wasn't getting it, you know. So I took some more tests, and she did better than I did. She always did. But I got a scholarship to a fine private Southern University, Baptist school, and I was on my way. That was good, huh? I was going to go to school and get my degree and do something fabulous. As long as I've never had to talk to more than two people at a time, it would be fine. So I went to school and took my tests and sort of hid out in my room. And when I got there that first day, my roommate was already there, and I had not met her. And she was from Alexandria, Virginia. She had long, dark hair. And she was smoking a cigarette. She had on cutoffs and a guitar. And she went, "Hey." And I went, "Oh, my role model has arrived. This is who I want to be when I grow up." And I just thought she was the coolest thing. We actually had fire escapes at this school. And she would sneak out the fire escape and get drunk and do whatever. Come back in and hold her gorgeous long hair she threw up. And I thought, why can't I have a life like this? Why can't I have fun? I'm not having any fun. What's going on here? But I was a real good student. And I needed a ride home one semester. And I found this boy who had a GTO. You may not know what that is. Four on the floor. And I thought, I'll never get to ride in a car like that. So I'll just do that once. That'll be kind of cool. And I did. And he kind of took a liking to me. That was different. Now, you have to realize, when I was in high school, I was a good girl. I didn't smoke. I didn't drink. I didn't wear black eye makeup. I thought smoking would get you pregnant. I mean, I didn't know about all that other stuff. I was just not, I was very, very naive. So I had no frame of reference for what boys were all about. And he liked me, and he was kind of sophisticated. So he took me out a few times, and we kind of got to know each other. And he came from a family that had, let's just say it, they were just filthy rich is what it was. They just had a whole heck of a lot of money. And I had never been around people like this. It was very odd to me. And after we went together a couple years, he said, "Well, I have an idea. Why don't you go on vacation with us?" And I'm thinking, well, that's nice. We go up to Georgia or something, you know. He said, "No, no, we're going to go on my yacht to the Bahamas." And see, in my house, we didn't use words like yacht and Bahamas. We weren't there at all. And so talking my father into this was a real big deal. And so we went to my dad, and we were getting pretty serious by this time, and he somehow let me go. And so I got in this yacht, and I go to the Bahamas. And I'm 19 years old. I've never had a drink, never been around drinking. My grandmother was a member of the WCTU, Women's Christian Temperance Union, and we just weren't doing that kind of stuff at my house, you know. And we get to the Bahamas on the yacht. I like to say that. It sounds so cool. Even today, I haven't been yachting in the Bahamas since I was 19, let me tell you. It kind of went downhill from there. But so we go to this place, a club, kind of looked like a bar to me, on Bay Street in Nassau, called Dirty Dick's. That was the name. I had the ashtray for years. I was real proud of that. And so we go, and we go in this place. And his mother said, "What would you like to drink?" I said, "Oh, no, I don't drink. I'm not that kind of girl." And she said, "Oh, honey, it's legal here." Well, God forbid that I break a law and not drink if it's legal there, you know. But I didn't know much about this. I said, "Well, you order for me." So she ordered me a Tom Collins. Comes with a little umbrella, little piece of orange, you know, a little fruit. And it's got a nice, refreshing taste. No air conditioning in that place. I had one. I felt significantly better. I had two. I felt even better. And that fear began to go away. I hear people talk about, "I got taller, I got prettier." Not me. Not me. I got louder. That voice that had been way down there, it was booming. And again, I told you I was a good reader. Well, apparently I had read some off-color material at some point because I cussed this guy up one side and down the other right in front of his mom and dad. I just found him woefully inadequate to a woman like me at my stature at 19 years old. And I just cussed him out. And then I threw up. And then I blacked out. And then we went back to the yacht in the Bahamas. And so I got up the next morning feeling like you feel after your first drunk, and I thought, what do they do now? Do you walk the plank? What do they do to you when you do something like this? I was horrified. I was just horrified and scared. We didn't have the money in my family to fly me back home to Miami. And his mother sat me down, we had a little family conference, and said words to me that changed my life. And she said, "Honey, that wasn't you talking. That was the alcohol." And I went, "Of course." And you know, unfortunately, I took that to the bank for years. It was not me, it was the alcohol. So we got engaged and we got married. We had a lovely country club wedding, even though I'd never set foot in a country club before that day. And off we went to our new and wonderful, trudging the road of happy destiny, not, you know, and lived in Miami in a lovely home. And he had a very social family, very active in the community. And we'd go to these big parties. And so I got into this habit, which everybody in here will go, well, maybe not the Al-Anons, but everybody else will go, okay. And my husband used to make him crazy. Before I would go, I'd get my dress on, I'd look real nice. I'd go to the sink, I'd grab the scotch, I'd pour it in a water glass, drink it down, like Alka-Seltzer, you know. And then I was ready to go to the party. Calm me down, gave me my voice, was ready to go. If they were short supply, I was already on board, you know. So he came out one night, and I've got my glass of scotch, and I just downed it, you know. It's not real tasty right off the bat. And he said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm having a drink." "Why? We're going to a party." I said, "That's why. I'm having a drink because we're going to a party." He said, "But why are you having a drink?" "Because I'm going to a party." You know, and it was like one of those who's on first deals. He just did not understand the importance of the pre-drink drink. Well, all alcoholics understand the importance of the pre-drink drink. So I had an MO. What I would do is I'd go to the party. I would pick out somebody's boyfriend or husband, preferably. I would make a pass at him. I would make a fool of myself. I would throw up, and we would go home. And that's what I did. And then I learned about amends very early. Then the next morning, I would cry. I'd pick up the phone and say how sorry I was. And I would do this every time we went out. And I guess that's not amends, because amends, you're not supposed to keep doing it after you make amends. But I did. And that marriage wasn't going well. And I realized what the problem was. It came to me. It was him. So I had to get out of there, and I got out of there. I was in my noble phase. I took no money, no clothes, no jewelry, no nothing, just my crummy little car, and away I went. I'll tell you what, I was young, you know? And so away I went. But my test-taking ability was still there, and they were to kind of recruit women for big companies back in those days. And so I took some tests, and I got a job in sales and marketing in this big international corporation based in Cincinnati, Ohio, that will remain nameless. And they hired me to do marketing around the country, and how we did that is I get a telegram on Friday to tell me where to be on Monday. And I didn't live anywhere. I lived in Stouffer's Hotel, and so I'd do that. And I found out that if you booked at the very last minute, and the flights were full, you could fly first class. Well, the good thing about first class is you can drink. And it went very well. I was very good at that job. I was still at the point where I could control, well, I couldn't really control it, but I could back it down once in a while, except when I get off in San Diego when I was supposed to be in Los Angeles. Now, that was not a good thing, but I did. You know, I'd do that. But I never got caught, you know. I was just kind of rolling through life. And on one of my trips to Columbus, my hometown, I met my next victim. I had the trap and keep syndrome, where I would find a victim, set the trap. I found out later what I was doing was called a paradoxical intervention, but hadn't been to school again yet. I didn't know what I would just tell him. I can't possibly get married. I'm over that. I can't. I'm a free bird, and he'd have to have me. So I found this gorgeous artist, and he was just a lovely man, and we were going to settle down or something. And so he decided he would marry me, and that was nice. And so I quit that job, and I married him. Keep count here, because this gets real out of control real fast. I'm sorry to tell you. You know, I tell this story now, and I keep thinking, I'm really going to have to talk to my grandchildren before they come to one of these meetings. So I marry him, and I work for a living for about 6 months, and I am not liking this go-to-work-every-day thing. This is boring, you know. I'm a free bird. I have to fly. So I still had this great engagement ring, and I talked to him, and I said, "Look, we need a bigger life here. So we will. You're an artist. You need to see the great paintings in Europe and everything. We will sell everything we own, and I will sell my ring, and we will go to Europe, and we will travel around." "Well, what happens when the money runs out?" "I don't know." That's later, you know. So we did. So we took off. My families thought we were crazy. And away we go. And we travel around Europe. And, you know, it was raining in Paris, so we go to Barcelona. I was so, God, just, I can't even, if I had a child like me, I'd just lock myself in a closet and never come out, you know. And that was before email or cell phones or anything. So I'm over there, and we went to Africa, and I met the hash cookie man in Barcelona. And he was down in Casablanca. And, you know, just stupid, crazy, out of control, weird life. But the drinking hadn't really gotten to the place where I couldn't, still I could hit the handbrake and I could back it down. Well, I was having a good time carrying a 40-pound pack, walking 10 or 12 miles a day, but my jeans didn't fit anymore after about 5 months. That was a problem. And I was just eating right and drinking a lot. But then I got real homesick and then I started getting sick. And we went home and I'm 4 months pregnant. The Al-Anons knew that already, didn't you? Never occurred to me that was going to happen. I don't know why. And so here we are pregnant. So I can't go out to California and be a hippie like I wanted to be. I had to stay in Ohio and have a baby. So we moved to Mansfield, Ohio. I don't recommend that, in case you're thinking about it, especially if you're from here. And I have this baby, and he's going to work, and I'm staying home. And this is not working for me. This is not working. So I tell him, we have to move to Florida. So we moved to Florida. I mean, I just, geographic was just my life, you know. So I got down there, and he had a job, and I didn't. And again, I'm in a house, I'm by myself, and I just always had this feeling there was more. I had this hole in my soul, and I just had to be more, you know, and I didn't know how to find it, and I didn't know what to do. So I got a job. My daughter was 2. And I became the assistant director of the Polk County Bicentennial Committee. This was 1976, and we were putting on this show. Nice bicentennial show, a little medicine show. And Uncle Sam was the MC. He was tall, he was good looking, and he was a lot younger than I was. I was in my late 20s, he was in his real early 20s. And I looked at my life and I knew what was the matter. Him again. You know, I just made bad choices in men. That's it. My mother agreed with me, by the way. And so I decided it was time to throw my lot in with Uncle Sam, and away we go. My husband was not happy with this decision at all. And he tried to talk me out of it, and what kind of life would my daughter have? But I said, it's going to be fun. It'll be fine. So I worked till the middle of the bicentennial year, and the most exciting thing happened. Our little bicentennial medicine show got picked up by a promoter, and we were going to go to every state fair east of the Mississippi. And we traveled with Dan Fleener's Hurricane Hell Drivers. And on the breaks, I would get in the car. We would go to places, and I'd get in the car, and they taught you how to flip. It was so great. You know, I just loved it. This is, my parents must have been so proud of their cum laude graduate of a fine university honing her skills with the Hell Drivers. We lived in a motorhome. No, this is an honest program. We lived in the truck house, as my daughter used to call it. It had kind of like that cab over the truck, and it was great. And we lived one day at a time. You got paid every day. You got drunk every day. You moved every day. And I went to every state fair. I really did. I was all up and down the eastern seaboard and over to, we got almost to Iowa once, and then we turned around and came back. But the bicentennial year, as all good things must, ended. Work again. Where to go, where to go. So we go to Orlando because I have a brother there who isn't too fond of me, but he is there. And in the truck house. And I whip out my skills. And I put on my nice little suit and my heels. And I go out testing and all that stuff. And I end up the executive director of a parenting program at a community college. I was creative. I had a lot of novel approaches to parenting, as my daughter will tell you. And it was hard. You had to drive, you had to unplug all the stuff from the truck house and drive it to the inner room, kind of around the corner. I had to sneak out, pull up my pantyhose, and away I went. And, you know, that was the deal. So I got this job. We moved into like a normal place, and life is clipping along. And I am starting to drink a little bit more. My husband's in college. He's getting his master's degree now, and I'm getting that old feeling. I'm getting that old feeling. And I couldn't control it. When that feeling came, it was like being on a roller coaster, and I had to do something. So what I did was that one of our board members came up to me and said, you know, I think you could do more than this job. I'm like, absolutely. What did you have in mind? He said, I have the perfect job for you. He said, I believe you would be wonderful on my team. I said, what is your team? He said, I am in pharmaceutical sales. You are going to sell drugs. I'm like, yes, indeedy, that works. You got a car, you got an expense account, you got insurance, it paid for your gas. And I didn't realize I'd probably be a single mother a few more times, so I better get some money going here. But I took that job, and the one barrier to my drinking had just been removed. We were living pretty poor up to that time, and I was making money like I'd never seen before with this company. Now, I had my scruples. I don't want you to think I'm a drug user, okay? I didn't do that. I drove drunk a lot, but I felt breaking the law that way was much more reasonable than taking drugs. So I only took prescribed ones. I used to go to a psychiatrist and pay him in cash. I had a great insurance program, but I felt he might tell somebody. I wanted him to like me, so I never told him the stuff about me. And he prescribed drugs, and they didn't fit well with alcohol, so they had to go. And that's just kind of how it was for me. And I started drinking a lot more, and I was a lot more out of control. And I got to the place where I just couldn't figure out what was wrong with my life. I just couldn't figure it out. And my husband and I were fighting more. He was seeing me just deteriorating, but I was very good at my job, and at the beginning I'd done extremely well. And you can go a long time on results when you're in sales, and people don't do anything to you. And I'd get stopped by cops, and they'd let me go because I was young and cute and redheaded. And so one day I went out to the Saints and Sinners Lounge, a lovely place. And I always remember what I'm wearing, which just tells you how shallow I really am, mashed potato queen that I've become. And I'm wearing this lovely blue suit with this little flounce on the blouse. And I had a little altercation with a fellow who did not respect me. And I think I threw the first drink, but I am not sure. And then he threw one, and then I threw one. And you know how that goes. I was very upset. And I had left my daughter. I had a daycare center that had evening hours, and she was in the daycare center, and I'd left her there. And so I ran out of the bar, crying, my usual hysterical self, and I went to get in my car, and I turned the wrong way in a city that I had lived in for years and years, and I got lost in my own town. I was very drunk. And I pulled off the side of the road, and I don't know what this was about, but I took off my pantyhose and took my purse and my pantyhose and locked them in the trunk. I don't know what that was. I was drunk. And I hid in the bushes from something until a car came. And this car had those real dark windows. You know how you get them real dark. And the guy opened the door, one of those real sports cars things, and he had sunglasses on. Come on in, honey. And I assumed that he would rape and kill me. I just thought that was logical at 3 o'clock in the morning. And so when I got in the car, I started screaming hysterically just to prepare myself for the trauma that was going to happen. And he's thinking, I got this crazy broad. We've got to do something here. So he pushes me out the door in front of the 7-Eleven, which is like a convenience store. And in those days, it was open from 7 to 11. And I'm sitting on the bread racks crying until the store opened and I bummed enough money to make a phone call. My daughter was at the daycare center, and I had forgotten. Now, I had not forgotten to pick her up. Get this part. I had forgotten I was a mother. That's what alcohol did for me. The most precious person in my life. I forgot. And I went home, and I was devastated. Just devastated at what my life had turned into. And I made a list, kind of like New Year's resolutions. And I wrote three things. I want to be a better mother. I want to be a better wife. And I don't want to drink for 30 days. And I might as well have written 300 years. Because I had no idea how people made that happen. No idea. But I knew, I was knowing it was a problem. And I started trying to quit. I'd make it 2-3 hours. You know, again, I was up to a bottle of scotch a day and then whatever drinks people bought for me when I was out. I'd drive with my daughter in the car when I was drunk. I would run off the road, and I can still hear her voice screaming as I'm trying to get the car right. I'm in and out of a blackout, and she's screaming. I felt she was overreacting. I had no sense of what was going on with me. My husband was extremely tired of the way I was behaving. My daughter's father, the husband before, we're now on three, was extremely tired of the way I was behaving. He was threatening to take her away from me, and I knew I had a problem. And it was him. That's how I worked. That's how my mind worked. So I began to look, trap and keep. That's how it works. And I went to my husband's office one day, and I met Prince Charming. I knew he was out there, and I met him. He said, "Would you like a drink?" Which to me is like, "I love you." And he took me out to his car. He opened the trunk of the car, and in the trunk of the car were call brands and ice and cups. We were meant for each other. Now, he had a liability that at the time I was unaware of, and I wish I had checked this out. He had an Al-Anon wife. And had I known what kind of amends were coming in my life, I tell you what, I would have run like crazy. But I had no sense. She did. I didn't. And so I decided that I was on to number four. And away I went. And my daughter was spending a lot of time with her father, which was a real good thing. I wasn't a good mother. I wasn't a good mother, you know. And that just kills me to say that out loud, but it's the truth. And I didn't have my child taken away from me. And I believe it's the grace of God and moments between me and the women that have had that experience. I'm no different than you, if that's your experience. So my boyfriend, my undivorced boyfriend and I, decided to go celebrate my brother's birthday, which was in November of 1981. And we went up to Jacksonville, which is Duval County. And we got up there, and we decided to go out and drink. What a shock. So we go to this club, and he and I got into one of our let's throw the drinks fights. And he stormed out. He didn't come back for a long time. I cannot have this. You know, I do this. You know, and so I can't have one letting go if I don't have the other one in the other hand. That just doesn't work for me. So I got up there, and I went outside to see what the trouble was. I'd had a few cocktails by that time. And he was with an off-duty Jacksonville police person who was dragging him handcuffed into the car. And I tried to explain to this cop this horrible mistake he was making, and he threatened to take me too. And so off I went to the Duval County Jail to try to bail him out. Well, this is very difficult to do if somebody won't give their name or speak English. And he would not speak English because he felt he'd been captured by the CIA. Now, he's a Chicago boy. I don't know what the not English was all about, you know. But he was speaking something. And I'm going to every ATM in town trying to get money, but it doesn't matter because they can't book him because he won't tell them who he is. And I went into the bathroom at the Duval County Jail. I don't know if you've ever been in a jail bathroom. I don't wish it on you, but if you have, you know what I'm talking about. And the mirror's kind of cracked, and the smell's real interesting, real gamey. And I had on this lovely little expensive number. I always know what I'm wearing when tragedy strikes. Got this little outfit on, and I look in the mirror, and I'm 33 years old, and I look at the mirror, and I say to myself, "What's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this?" And the mirror answered, and I heard as if it were spoken, "Mary, you're not a nice girl anymore. If you keep this up, you're going to die." Well, you want to hear that. So finally my boyfriend came to enough to give his real name, and the Duval County judge suggested we go back to Orange County and leave them alone. So we went back and we had a conference. We sat and talked about this very seriously, and I said, "We've got a problem." He said, "We do. We have a problem. What are we going to do?" And I said, "I have an idea. I love therapy. You have to know that. I just love it. You just pay people and they listen to you. It's the coolest thing." And so I started speed dialing every therapist I'd ever met. And I could not get an appointment. And he said, "I've got a better idea." I said, "What's your idea?" He said, "I think I'm going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous." I'm like, "Wait a minute. Wait a minute. Let's not go overboard here. Yeah, we have a little problem, but it's our issues. We get those worked out. This alcohol thing will just go away, you know?" Well, he was pretty adamant. He thought his father had an alcohol problem, and he did too, and he was going. My keen analytical mind kicked in, and I said to myself, if he goes to Alcoholics Anonymous, he will meet alcoholic women. And alcoholic women are sluts. Now, you may want to know how I knew this. intuitively, I knew how to handle a situation that might have baffled you all, but I knew. So I made a plan. I decided to go with him in disguise. I planned my outfit very carefully. I wore a pair of blue jeans. I wore a man's plaid shirt, big plaid shirt. I had some buttoning issues in those days. I was a little shaky, and the buttons, you know how they don't quite match up, and you look a little odd, but I thought, what the heck, they're alcoholics, they're not going to know. And I put on a big baseball cap, giant sunglasses, and away we went. So we get there, and I walk in, and I think, oh my God, we're in the wrong place. The church people are here. They're all looking like you all. They're clean and washed and happy and smiling, and there were women, bunches of women, and they didn't look real slutty to me, you know. But I could have been wrong. Appearances can be deceiving, as I was a good example of that. And so we sat down, and this girl comes running up to us. She's got little high heels on, even. Hi, I'm Diane. Are you new? And I'm like, how did she know? Oh, what a wise woman. So we sit in a circle, and I have never been to, heard of, I might have read about it someplace. We sit in a circle, and what I realized today is we had a first step meeting. And so they were telling their stories, how they got into AA. And I got this really sinking feeling, you know. And they got to me and they said, you want to say anything? And I said, my name's Mary. And I always wondered what a drunk looked like. And she looks a lot like me. And I was home. And I was scared. And I was mad. I was not happy to see you. I'm sorry to tell you. I was not happy to be here. But I had read that AA was kind of a cult, and so I came once a week, every Wednesday. I had great Wednesdays. Every other day was horrible, but Wednesdays were great. And somebody said to me, this girl Jeannie from Tennessee, she really irritated me. And she said, maybe if you came more often, you'd have better days. So she invited me to a Tuesday meeting. And we've been going about 2 months by this time. Life was not better. Going to meetings once a week, working no program and having no steps is just my idea of hell. You know, I was detoxing in the room. I was a quart-a-day drinker. I was seeing spiders on the wall. I mean, I was physically in terrible shape. So we go to this meeting after a couple months of undrunkenness. I hate to even call it sobriety. And the Al-Anon wife is saying stuff like, let go and let God. You know, let's pray about it. I'm like, doesn't she get speed dial divorce? What's wrong with this woman? You know, this is so quick and easy. I know how to do this. I'll help her. She didn't want my help. And I needed to get married. I just couldn't be hanging around single. This doesn't work for me. So we go to the meeting, and this guy, the chairperson, lets my husband share. My husband, oh my God. My boyfriend share. And he tells the sad tale of his Al-Anon wife and the no divorce. And the chairperson says, as chair people will do, keep coming back. It'll get better. And my boyfriend picked up the chair and threw it at him. Even in Central Florida, that is not good AA etiquette. Even there. So, two big guys from the Navy base escorted him out saying, have you had a third step yet, buddy? I'm crying my eyes out. And I'm thinking to myself, this is just great. I'm about to get thrown out of the lowest of the low. I'm about to get kicked out of the losers club. This is just fabulous. And so we run out after the meeting. People try and talk to us. I'm not talking any of this because I know what's coming. They're going to tell us we can't come back anymore. And I didn't have my checkbook that night. Seconds and inches, a speaker I've heard. Seconds and inches save our lives. And so I had to drive home to get the checkbook. So we get in the car and we're going to go drink. I've had enough of this nonsense. I am not happier. I am not feeling better. 2 months of no drinking is making me crazy. Everything is the same except I can see it all. It is not good. Early sobriety is not good, you know? I mean, when you don't have anything else going for you. So I get home, and I'm looking for the checkbook, and all of a sudden, there is AA police. If anybody tells you otherwise, they are lying. I open the door. There's Jeannie, the Tennessee girl. And her big boyfriend. The boyfriend takes my boyfriend into one room. And she looks at me and she says, listen, honey, you are going to have to get down on your knees every day and beg God for your sobriety. Or you're going to get drunk. And I said, excuse me, I don't believe that stuff. And she said, I don't think I asked you what you believed. I think I just told you what to do. Well, nobody had ever done that to me before. But you know, that was another moment of grace, because I knew she had my number, and I knew I was going to die. I was going to die if I drank again. And so I did what she said. And she said, I want you to, she said, here are the two things we need to do with you. Number one, you think you're so smart, you need to be de-smarted, and I'm the one to do it. Number two, you are no longer confident to talk to God. You can't do that yourself. So you will call me. I will call God. I will discuss your problem. I will call you back and tell you what God said. I will be your celestial telephone operator. And you know, I bought this stuff. I did it. I just figured I'm out of ideas. So every day, God help me stay sober. You know, that was how reverent I was. She gave me a phone list and said, now, if you can't get me, start calling the phone list of the home group. She said, but there may come a day when you can't get anybody on the phone. And if that day comes, you're going to have to talk to God yourself. But you're not ready. I'm like, okay. And one Saturday night, about a month after that, I don't know, if you've never had this happen, you might not know what I'm talking about, but there's a roller coaster that my emotions would get on, and you could feel it clicking, 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 and you knew it was going to go so far down, and the only antidote for that was a drink, the only antidote. And I felt it going, and I felt it going. It was the first time I'd had that really powerful desire to drink. So I called Jeannie. She is not home in my hour of need. It is Saturday night. Where is she? There's no meeting. What do alcoholics do on Saturday anyway? She should be home. So I got out the list, just like she told me. I went down the numbers. Nobody in that home group was home. Liars, all liars. They said they'd be there. They weren't there. But it was, the feeling was getting bigger and stronger and bigger and stronger. And I had to do something. So I got on my knees. And I said, God, if you're there, which I doubt, do something. And he did. And I had a moment of the presence of the living God right there. I was an atheist, and 5 seconds later, there was no doubt, there was a God who loved me and cared about me, drunk or sober. I could drink again, but I could never not know again. My ignorance was gone. Well, I was blown away, and the desire to drink left me at that moment. Well, I got on the phone to her the next morning to chastise her for her malfeasance and also to give her some big news. I said, Jeannie, there's a God. She said, we knew that, Mary. Now start writing your 4-step. No, I can't do that. I cannot do that because I was a very bad girl. I did bad things. I hurt people. And I was afraid. I was afraid nobody would want me around. But she insisted, and I did it, and we sat down together, and she did the most loving thing, and I still do it today when I sponsor women and listen to their 5th step. She said, before you start, I'm going to take your hands, and we're going to pray, and we're going to ask God to enter into this. I'm going to pray holding hands with a woman. Ooh. Yeah. But I really trusted her, you know, and so I did. And she invited God in and asked for guidance and wisdom for her and courage for me. And then she said, I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to tell you the worst thing I have ever done and why and what character defect of mine that illustrates. And she did. It was good. Real good. And I'm very competitive, and so I felt it was time to enlighten her what a real bad girl was like. And I took my 5th step with her, and she said something very prophetic to me. She said, you know, as we went through those character defects, she said, someday your pride is going to take you down. Be very, very careful. Well, I didn't listen too hard, and the Al-Anon wife had gotten sick of all of us by this time and had decided to go on to her own new and wonderful life, and she divorced my boyfriend, and so I was going to get married, and Jeannie said, I do not think you are ready for a relationship. And I thought, it's God's will. God brought us together. God brought us here. We're going to get married. I said, don't do that. Well, I felt I knew best by this time. I was 8 months sober. I had worked some steps, by gosh. And I was ready. And we had our little AA wedding with our little AA bridesmaids and our little AA children. We walked down the AA aisle into Happy Destiny, and it was all good. And if that were the truth, I'd be done right now. But I got news for you. I'm still talking. And there you go. So I got married again. And I loved Alcoholics Anonymous. I really embraced it, and it embraced me, and I got very active. And I'm one of those people. My husband said, as he gave instructions for me on how to do this tonight, he said, your story, Mary, is you got it, you lost it, and you luckily got it back. And that's the truth. Because at the beginning, I was just all over AA. But something began to happen. My husband was not like an AA as much as I did. And he didn't want to come so much. I came every day. He didn't want to do that. And that began to bother me. And as time passed, he didn't want to go at all. So I went to Al-Anon and asked them to help me get him back into AA. I felt they could do this for me. I'd heard about them. And I had a plan, and I wanted them to help me implement it. My plan was I would go to AA meetings, find all the really good sobriety, male sobriety, and I would bring them to my house one at a time, and he could interview them. He needed a sponsor. And they suggested I work on myself. And I said, I am. That's what I'm doing here. And they weren't having it. So I went ahead, and it was just horrible. And it got worse, and it got worse, and I just didn't know what I was going to do if I had to get divorced again. I could see it coming. You know, the marriage was falling apart. Things were getting ugly. My daughter was getting older. I was a good mother, pretty a good mother at this point. And when she had left that stepfather that she was so close to, Uncle Sam, she had said to me, won't I ever get to see him again, Mom? And I said, sure you will, honey. You'll get to see him again when you graduate from high school. She was 9. And just before she graduated from high school, my daughter is a genetic Al-Anon. I don't know if any of you know any of those, but some people are just born Al-Anon, and she was born. And she went to Alateen. And so she came to me and she said, Mom, I need that phone number. I'm like, what phone number? She said, my stepfather. I want to see him. Well, I wasn't having that either, because he was the person who was there when I was at my worst. But I went to my home group and they said, that's your amends. What you took away was relationship. What you return is relationship. I'm sorry it doesn't cut it. So I gave her the number. She called him. And within a day, he had flown in from Houston, where he lived, and saw her. And that has been, to this day, a wonderful, wonderful, supportive relationship. And that was one of my big lessons. I knew I was going to have to go back to work full time. I had a daughter going into college. I needed money. I knew my marriage was falling apart. So I went out and did my thing, took some more tests, make some more money, found another big pharmaceutical company that was a competitor of my other company. They flew me up to Philadelphia for training. By this time, I had been an AA lion for about 7 years. I was 10 years sober. I wanted to die every day. I talked about my wonderful relationship with God. I talked about my wonderful marriage. And I lied, and I lied, and I lied. I had no sponsor. I had no close women friends. I couldn't. My house was a dark place. And when my daughter left, it was darker. So I went up to this company's home office. I was on the bus. They had this little limo thing that takes you in. And I sort of leaned my head against the wall, and I said, God, I don't know if I can do this again. I'm almost 45 years old. I'm tired. And I don't even know if I want to live anymore. My daughter's launched, and she'll be okay. I just don't know if I can do it. But if you want me to, help me. And But I'm trained. I'm a good Alcoholics Anonymous member. I know what I'm supposed to do. And I got there and I called the local AA club and I said, I really need a meeting. I need somebody to come and get me. They said, well, real busy. We'll call you back. They didn't. Well, like Pennsylvania people, I don't know, you know. I called them back and I said, you know, I've been waiting here for an hour and I haven't heard from anybody. And the guy was real testy with me and he said, Azita, I told you I'd call you back. And he hung up on me. We got my name wrong. That was kind of annoying. So the next day, I put on that navy blue suit and those little pumps, and I walked into the meeting room, and this was kind of an elite group. There were only 10 of us from around the country, and we had little bronze nameplates, and I looked up, just sighing like I was going to die. I couldn't do this anymore. And sitting across from me was this tall, gorgeous Iranian girl, and her name was Azita from Los Angeles, California. Okay. I got interested. I went up to her at the break, and I was cool. I said, by any chance, are you acquainted with Dr. Bob or Bill Wilson? She went, oh, my God, my sponsor told me you'd be here. She told me. I'm like, who's your sponsor? She gave me some name I never heard of. I said, how do I know her? And she said, oh, no, you don't understand. I'm 6 months sober, and I was afraid I was going to drink. And she told me if I prayed, God would send somebody. Well, I'm not sure who God sent to who, but I'll tell you this. I had a great 3 weeks, and I remembered Alcoholics Anonymous. I remembered what it was like to be sober. And I went home, and I ended that relationship, and it was very hard. And I had a friend named Chet. He was a divorce lawyer. Everybody like me needs a divorce lawyer. And when I left that marriage, he declared his intention that I probably ought to marry a divorce lawyer, given my history. Speed the process, you know. And he had been my dear and good friend for many years, and he declared his intention, and I looked at him and thought, you know, you got a point there. It was the first guy I didn't trap and keep, you know. That right there was kind of amazing. And so I got my divorce May 13th, and one of his friends walked it through for me, and he said, you know, being a lawyer and all that, I can go get the certified copy right now, and I've got 30 minutes before my next client. We can walk right next door to the clerk of the circuit court. We can walk right upstairs, and for an extra $25, we can even get married in the courtroom. I thought this was terribly romantic. I now look at it as an economic decision. I'm still not sure. So I had my divorce dress on. Women like me need divorce dresses. It was brown, had little brown flowers, very sad, and you know. So I got married in my divorce dress. 30 minutes after I was single for 30 minutes. You know, I hate to tell that story to women I sponsor, because you know what, that just blows everything you're going to say out of the water. So we got married, and I needed to find something to do with myself. I was back in the programs. He had always been very serious about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I decided my love is school. I love going to school. I'm a school junkie. And I decided that I would go and enhance my spiritual life. If you ever hear me say that, lock me up somewhere. And how I was going to do it is I'm going to take a course in Thomas Merton and become a mystic. Don't I look like a mystic? So I didn't do that. That class, by the grace of God, was closed. And so I took the GRE prep class, which is graduate record exam, and I took that test, and I went up to that university I had blown my way through all those years ago and convinced them that they should take me into their graduate school without any test scores, just on the strength of who I was 30 years ago. And they did, and they did. And you'll never guess what I studied. I was going to become a marriage and family therapist. A mental health counselor. I felt it was time for some mental health. And I was sponsored then, and my sponsor approved this plan, believe it or not. And she looked at me and she said, here's the deal. You go up there, you do your homework, you do your class presentations, you be useful to other people, and don't you tell anybody you're an alcoholic. Don't you go be special, and don't you specialize in alcoholism either. I'm like, okay. And I did. And that scared girl learned how to do a lot of things she didn't know how to do. I did my internship at an AIDS resource center. My clients all died. They were all very young. It was before the good drugs came out. And I learned how to be with dying. I, who was terrified to speak to more than one person at a time, learned to sit at the bedside. And I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned to be with people in bad situations from you all. So I graduated, and I was getting ready to go to work for hospice. It was my love, and it still is. That's the work I adore. And my daughter came to me, my little genetic Al-Anon. She told me she was getting married, and I was so thrilled. Her fiancé was a wonderful man. He had been married before, had 2 children, but she knew how to blend a family because I had a wonderful relationship by now with her father and her stepmother. And she said, I have something to tell you, though. I said, what's that? She said, I'm going to invite them all. I said, all who? The dads. And the girlfriend. I'm like, wait, I'll get back to you. I call my sponsor. Now, I, you know, two and three and five were fine, but four was a problem. He was a problem for me. I didn't want to see him again. And the girlfriend. Good grief. There's enough's enough, you know. My sponsor said, your job is to be a wonderful mother of the bride. Be the kind of mother that every girl wants, and you just don't get to have that. You don't get that choice anymore. Well, I said yes, but there was resentment in my heart. And the day of the rehearsal dinner, I went to my meeting at noon, and I cried bitter tears. And I talked about the injustice of a fine, upstanding Alcoholics Anonymous member like me having to go through this. And my sponsor was at the meeting, and she wrote me a note in the middle of the meeting, which has never happened before. Pushes it over, and the note said, you're not the bride, sweetheart. I miss that. I was so often, it was hard to let go of that bride. So I wasn't the bride. My daughter had a beautiful wedding. I was a wonderful mother of the bride. I shook hands with the ex. I hugged the girlfriend. My Al-Anon friends did the seating. I handed them the place card and said, "Just I can't handle this." They seated me with my back to the you-know-who and the you-know-who's what. And we did just fine. It was a lovely day. And anytime I get thinking I'm real special, I just pop out that videotape and plug it in. And I realize that not all of you may have your amends on tape, but I've got some of mine. So my daughter got married, and life went along beautifully. I had a granddaughter. And then something happened, and it happened to all of us. And that was 9/11. And by this time, I had a lot of training in disaster and grief and loss and things like this. And I had this lovely little private practice. I still have my little office, but I knew I had to do something. So I called my husband, and I said, you know, I want to go. He said, I knew that. And I called my daughter, who was pregnant with her second child. I said, honey, if you don't want me to go, I won't go, but I got to go. And she said, Mom, I knew that before you called me. And I called all my clients. And I said, if anybody tells me no, I won't go. And they all said, you got to go. So I flew up to Philadelphia on a plane that was empty after I was body searched, my little Red Cross badge on, and I expected to go to New York, and I ended up in Washington, D.C. at the Pentagon. And the girl who was too scared to talk to people, too scared to be out there and do anything with her life, spent 3 weeks up there. And during that time, my stepson was 6 months sober, and he was at... He was in Washington, D.C. at that time. His little young people's group called me every day. They left messages. I couldn't go anywhere. I couldn't go to meetings. They left messages every day encouraging me and telling me they were thinking about me and telling me to stay sober. It was awesome. And I came home, and on the ride home, my daughter called me. I took a train home. And she said, I just thought you'd like to know that you're going to have your first grandson. So excited. And so the time came for that baby. And I'll tell you, we don't talk a lot about amends in AA. Everybody talks about the first three steps. But I'll tell you, the amends steps have been powerful with my children, powerful in my life. And in that hospital room waiting for the arrival of this little boy was my daughter's father, his wife, my son-in-law, his mother, his two children from a former marriage, and me. I mean, she said, I just need grandstand seating with my family, you know, waiting for this baby. And so he came out, and he was born. And remember, I spent years in pharmaceutical sales, and my specialty was neonatal medicine. He was born, everybody was celebrating and so excited. And I was watching. I didn't like what I was seeing. Little chest was retracting, and little cry was a little too weak, and I didn't like it. He was on time. He was the right weight. And suddenly the nurses and doctors got a little more focused. You know, they just focused in, and I didn't like it. They took him to the nursery. They did some respiratory therapy. But, you know, I had this heaviness in my heart. Just had a heaviness in my heart. And I went home, and I went to sleep, and I prayed, and went back the next day. And we were playing, we had the baby, and we're looking at him. And you know how you open him up and count the fingers and toes and all that, and watching the baby, and all of a sudden, his little feet turned blue, like navy blue. I mean blue. And that blue just started coming up his body, and my heart stopped beating. My daughter picked him up and whacked him, and then I can't really tell you the sequence of events because it's like slow motion, fast. All of a sudden, we're running down the hall with this tiny baby on a big gurney, and I'm dialing. I'm calling my two best friends in AA, just like a long time ago. I needed an operator to call God for me. I was busy, and they did. By that night, they called everybody. And that night came, and they put him in the neonatal unit where he belonged. And my daughter was discharged from the hospital. She had three little girls at home that were crying, waiting for the little brother that wasn't coming. And my son-in-law had to take her home, and so I was chosen to keep watch that night. And I had on my, I always know what I'm wearing. I had on my black pantsuit, I had a Diet Coke and a bag of M&Ms, and I was good to go. And I sat in that nursery, and I held him. And the nurse says to me, "If you keep holding him, you're going to spoil him." I'm like, "And your point is what? I'm his grandmother, for God's sake, you know." Now, you need to know something about this night. This was March 28th, and it was the night before Easter Sunday. And if you are not of the Christian tradition, I must tell you that Easter Sunday for a priest in a big church is like Super Bowl Sunday for an NFL coach. It's big, big. And I went to a church with assistants and sub-assistants and, you know, all that jazz. So it's a big day. So about 4 o'clock in the morning, you can imagine my surprise when the head priest shows up wearing jeans and a sweatshirt. And I said something really sensitive, like, "What are you doing here?" He said, "I don't know. I just woke up and I thought I was supposed to come here, so here I am. Maybe we should pray for the baby." I'm like, "Okay." We prayed for the baby. Nothing big. He left. But I noticed that that first line of light before the light was coming. Dawn was breaking. And the baby was breathing okay, you know, he looked okay. So my daughter got there and my son-in-law, and the neonatologist took a look at him and said, "This baby's fine. Looked at all the tests, he's fine. In fact, he's so fine he can go home today." Now I want to tell you what the miracle was. Don't miss this. The miracle wasn't the baby. He was always going to be okay if God had that in his mind. He was prayed for and cared for. The miracle was the woman who drove drunk with her daughter in the car. The woman who forgot she had a daughter. The woman who could not stay married, who couldn't be faithful, who couldn't show up for anybody or anything, was chosen to keep watch that night. And I learned that here. Every call I made, every pot of coffee, every chair I set up, every ashtray moved me to that night where I could keep watch and go the distance. And that morning, more than one resurrection happened. And for the first time, I knew I was a good mother and a good grandmother. And I had been healed by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the steps and the people. And it was amazing. It was amazing to me. And I knew it. Well, the neonatologist came out and he said, "You can take the baby home as soon as I whack his weenie." Now, for those of you not medically inclined, I want to explain that terminology. That's another word for circumcision. So they whacked his weenie. And he went home. And he's 4 years old now. He's just a joy. And his parents were out of town a little while ago, and I got to take him to a four-year-old boy birthday party, not his, another boy. And if you don't have any four-year-old boys in your life, they go around karate chopping the air. Very exciting. And they yell a lot, and they eat weird food. And so we went to this party. And at the end of the party, he's just a dear little soul, and he had a little, they give you goodie bags with all his stuff in it, you know, like candy and stickers and weird stuff. And he came up beside me, grabbed my hand, and said, "Grandma, that was a great party." I said, "It was, Mac, wasn't it?" He said, "You know the best part." I said, "What?" He said, "Look at this goodie bag. I got wee Wally Pops." And I thought, you know, Mac and I have a lot in common. For 24 and a half years, it's been a great party. And my goodie bag is full beyond my wildest imagination. Thank you for my sobriety. Thank you for my life.